Hello. Imagine, if you will, the basic building blocks of medicine. Substances broken down to a molecular level where, if you find the right recipe, particles will snap together in wondrous new forms, creating something that could save lives. That's the chemical playground inhabited by today's guest, whose work in biomedical sciences has revolutionised treatments for viruses from hepatitis to HIV. Raymond Shinazi was born in Egypt, where his mother's brush with a potentially fatal illness during his childhood inspired an early fascination with medicine. Today, he's a professor of paediatrics and director of the Laboratory of Biochemical Pharmacology at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Indeed, it was Ray who first set up the university's now-renowned Center for AIDS Research, where work is currently underway to develop an HIV vaccine. Ray's work in the early days of HIV studies led to the creation of drugs that the majority of people with the virus still take today, while his contribution to developing a cure for hepatitis C has saved millions of lives around the world. These medical milestones have earned Ray various awards, including France's highest civilian honour, the Légion d'honneur. Raymond Shinazi, welcome to the Life Scientific.
Thank you so much.
Now, what is it about manipulating molecules and creating new compounds that you find so fascinating?
Well, you're basically the creator of something new, completely new, that nobody's ever made before. You make these molecules, and you hope that they will target the enzyme that you're targeting selectively, and that's what is fascinating to me.
And obviously, there's a whole world of diseases out there. What's the particular appeal, if I can use that word, of viruses?
Well, viruses are life-threatening. So my thinking was try and work on something that's important, something that kills babies, something that goes into your lungs like COVID and destroy your lung. So this is what's important for me, to do something useful.
I mentioned in the introduction that the drugs you developed in the 80s and 90s are still a key part of combination treatments for HIV patients today. How does it feel to have had a hand in transforming what was basically a death sentence into a perfectly livable condition?
These viruses are very small, but they can cause havoc in a body and affect families. And I couldn't just sit around and do nothing. I had to use my skills to basically find something that would work selectively against these viruses.
Well, Ray Shinazi, you were born in March 1950 in Alexandria, Egypt. What do you remember about growing up there?
Oh, I love Egypt. It's a beautiful country. It's a beautiful people. I was born underwater, basically, in the Corniche, what we call the Corniche.
Along the seafront.
It's the seafront. It's a bit like Cannes. And basically, Alexandria is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. The weather is perfect there. You don't need air conditioning. And I enjoyed going to eat Middle Eastern food with my family and going to prayers on Friday and enjoying the family. We had a very extensive family.
How was school life?
I was interested in sports, swimming, diving, but I wasn't good at science or anything else. I just had difficulties, especially with mathematics. But I'm very fortunate I was able to study Arabic, I was able to study sciences, and I knew I was more interested in the practical aspects of studying.
Well, you were already slightly drawn to the world of medical sciences, partly due to that formative experience I mentioned in the introduction of your mother getting ill. Tell me about that.
Correct. And that was a very tough time because I thought I was going to lose my mother. Fortunately, we were able to get the medicine from the U.S. that actually cured her.
What was wrong with her?
She had a yeast infection after a miscarriage. And she was ready to die, basically. And the drug just worked so beautifully. It's a common drug. It's an antifungal agent called micastatin. And taking the pills for a few days basically reduced her stomach, which was bloated, completely bloated due to the yeast infection, to normal size. And my mother lived to be 94 years old. So it's amazing how these little pills made a big difference.
Of course. And there was also another influence, wasn't there? An uncle who'd moved to the US to study virology, who I gather your grandparents were exceptionally proud of.
Yes, my uncle, André Nahmias, is a famous virologist, a herpes virologist. And he came to the US from Egypt in 1948 and studied at the University of Austin and George Washington University. And he became a medical doctor and specializes in herpes virus infection when herpes wasn't very well known. There was no treatments. The herpes caused havoc in children. A baby who has herpes has a 94% chance of dying. Today, with the antivirals, cells that we have for herpes viruses, we can bring the death rate down to about 20%. So it's really made the difference.
Mm. Well, as listeners might know, this was a period of some upheaval for Egypt. So a very quick history lesson. In the 1950s, Gamal Abdel Nasser had come to power following the revolution in 1952. And in the wake of the Suez Crisis in 56, and then a few years later, Syria dropping out of its political union with Egypt, Nasser's regime decided to exert their authority by expelling a large number of people from the country, many British and French nationals, as well as many Egyptian Jews, including your family. You were only 12 years old. What do you remember from that time?
Well, we came back from a beach called Agami with my family, and the house was sealed. We couldn't get into our own home, and we had to go and spend the night at a hotel. Our bank accounts were frozen. Our companies were frozen. So we had nothing at all. I couldn't go to school anymore. And to me, it was a bit of an adventure, but for my parents, I could see it from their faces how anxious they were. And it took about 2 years, even though we held the Italian passport and the family had been in Egypt for more than 300 years, they decided they had no choice but to leave the country. So we weren't really expelled. We were basically forced to leave. Mm. My parents had no more jobs. And they also thought about their children. I have a sister. And clearly we had to leave to move on.
Yeah, yeah. I gather you have a very specific memory of being on the boat leaving Egypt.
Yes, and my father took me down to the room where we were sleeping and told me not to go upstairs and not to look back. But to me, my heart was always, this was my country. It's my country of birth. I mean, you can't escape that. I loved Egypt. Yes, there was political upheaval. Yes, there was discrimination. But we went on with our lives, ended up in a refugee camp in Italy.
Mm. You arrived in Naples in 1964 as refugees, but you were Italian nationals.
Yes, my mother actually was born Egyptian. My father was Italian, and she became Italian too, thanks to my father. So that's how we got the nationality. Right. I became Italian too, so I was born Italian. Now I'm American, but at the time, the only place we had to go was the refugee camp in Italy. That's the only country that welcomed us.
And how were you treated there when you arrived?
The Italian government was wonderful to us. I mean, there weren't masses of refugees in those days like there is today. I think there was only one other family with us at the time. And I heard that the place where we were kept in Naples is still there, even today. I've not visited it, but I hear it's still there. The refugee camp is still there, so they're still being used. But we were there for a few months. And then we had to move on. My father had found a job in Spain, and he decided to move to Spain.
But you got a scholarship to go to a boarding school in the UK, in Oxfordshire. How did you feel about leaving your family, adapting to boarding life in England?
It's very tough for a young man who's only 13 years old, arriving in England. I did speak English, but not broken English. And I was very fortunate to get that scholarship, which was set aside for students coming from Egypt who need support. So I ended up in a boarding school just south of Oxford.
Hmm. Actually, I gather it was at this point you really started to knuckle down as a student as well, discovering an aptitude for science.
Yes, I was very fortunate. I was roomed with a very bright young man, and he had a penchant for science. And I learned a lot from him. I tried to be like him in a way. And it was a great experience, a lot of discipline, a lot of cross-country running. And the best part was that we had an amazing chemistry teacher. He inspired me to become a chemist.
Almost always, it's an inspiring teacher, isn't it, that points you in the right direction in your career. In addition to this flair for science, you also did very well in languages, perhaps unsurprising. You know, you grew up speaking Arabic, French, English, all fluently. Yes. You were taught Hebrew, I believe, at the school. So that's not bad going. Your A-levels earned you a place at the University of Bath to study chemistry. And it was there that you discovered a passion for being in the lab, playing with molecules. This really came to the fore during your PhD when you successfully created a much more refined version of an existing compound called elliptocene.
Correct. That's a DNA intercalator and anti-cancer drug, and was able to develop a chemical route to making this compound very effectively. I was able to make all the reactions at low temperature, so you had a very pure product at the very end, beautiful color, orange color, And once you have the methodology worked out, you could make many analogs thereof. So that opened the opportunity for me to scale up the compounds and make sufficient amount of powder to be able to test against cancer. So we actually sent our compound to the National Cancer Institute in the United States. But unfortunately, we had to wait something like 6 months to get the results. And even when the results came, I didn't understand what the results were. And that actually made me think that maybe I should learn biology. Chemistry was not sufficient.
Well, after your PhD in 1976, you took up a postdoctoral fellowship in pharmacology at Yale. So yes. Why America?
Well, I liked the idea of working at one of the finest universities in the United States. And the subject was on nucleoside chemistry, which I knew nothing about. And the advantage is when you do a postdoctoral fellowship, you want to do something that you've never done before. You want to do something completely different. I didn't even know the structure, how to draw the structure of a nucleoside, which is the building blocks for DNA and RNA. And I basically had to learn very fast. I was first started as a chemist. But after about 2 years there, my boss at the time, William Prusoff, who was the grandfather of antiviral agent, he discovered one of the earliest compound that treats herpes keratitis, herpes of the eye. And he allowed me to go into the lab and learn how to handle mice, which is beyond what I'm used to working with chemicals. So I could actually work with the living things and understand how the interaction between the compounds we were making and the living body.
Well, your work at this point was focused on nucleoside chemistry, as you mentioned. Can you just set out how these nucleosides, small biomolecules that are part of the building blocks of DNA and RNA, how they can help us tackle viruses?
Yes, because every living creature on the planet has DNA or RNA. And when you make a surrogate nucleoside, a compound that looks like the nucleoside but is modified slightly, what you need is to fool the virus to take up that fraudulent nucleoside. So instead of the enzyme taking up a natural nucleoside building block, it takes up your molecule, and that molecule then inhibits the virus.
The enzyme, its job is to make copies of the virus.
Correct.
To replicate
Correct.
It. And so if you feed it the wrong instructions, it can't make more copies.
Not only that, but it causes chain termination.
Right.
And it doesn't touch the cellular DNA, and that's where the specificity of the compound comes from.
I know enough biology to understand that the enzyme normally in our body, the polymerase, makes copies of our DNA. But of course, the virus also needs to make copies of itself when it gets inside the cell. So it needs its own polymerase enzyme to do the job for it.
Whenever there's a crisis, like there was for COVID not too long ago, we come to nucleosides. And in fact, two of the drugs that were used to combat COVID are nucleoside analogs.
Right. Well, in the late 70s, after your Yale fellowship, you moved to Emory University in Atlanta to work on the herpes virus, studying what at the time was a presumed link between herpes and cancer.
Correct. And I worked with a professor in the dental school because orolabial herpes was a big issue. And also in children, herpes gets into your brain and calcifies it.
And it's quite different in children from adults, isn't
Correct. It? Correct. In adults, it's less pathogenic. In the child, you get an infection anywhere on the body that can go into the brain and calcify the brain. In adults, it's much more rare, but it can happen. But we now have drugs that can combat that, thankfully.
Well, Ray Shanazi, something happened soon after that which set your work on a whole new course, the AIDS epidemic. Do you remember when you first heard about it?
Yes, when people just didn't know what it was. We had no idea whether it's going to be a yeast infection, a bacterial infection, or a viral infection. And I remember discussing that with my uncle at the time, trying to figure out what it was. And it wasn't until Luc Montagnier and Bob Gallo confirmed that it was a virus. That was very important. And once we knew it was a virus, to me, I had to do something.
I gather your lab was next to one of the wards, and you'd see all these HIV patients lining up outside your office.
At the time, I was at the VA Medical Center in Atlanta, and the director of the center was smart enough to put me next to the infectious disease doctor. And outside his office were these primarily men, there were a few women. They were all sitting there and looked very depressed. But slowly, slowly, we set up the first AIDS lab. That is a method of growing the virus and studying antivirals against the virus. We were one of the few labs in the world that had the assay available in our lab. And, you know, nobody wanted to work with this virus because it's so dangerous. And
people were scared to even come close to your lab because there was such a fear about it before you'd made all these breakthroughs. Correct.
Yes, well, somebody has to do it, I guess. And we were very successful because we started getting some hits, which became leads, and leads became drugs.
Well, Ray, that work paid off. And within a few years, your lab had some major breakthroughs. We're going to talk about the science behind them in a moment, but first, can you set out exactly what HIV does to the body?
HIV really is one of the nastiest viruses in the world because it tackles the immune system. The virus has a great affinity for these lymphocytes that are white cells in your body, and it basically gets in there. And there's two paths. One is establishing latency, meaning it remains dormant in the cells, in a dormant form that can be reactivated at any time. And the one that actually kills the cells.
And of course, just as you've been doing with the drugs to treat the herpes virus, you had to design a compound that would inhibit the viral enzyme, the enzyme that makes copies of this virus.
Yeah, so the particular case of HIV, it has a very specific enzyme called reverse transcriptase. And that enzyme is only found in HIV and retroviruses. The body does not have that enzyme at all. So if you target that enzyme successfully, you can basically destroy the virus selectively. But the problem is that you can't eradicate the virus to this day because there is a latent form. And the drugs really cannot do much against this latent form.
Because it's not trying to make copies of itself. It's just sitting
basically
there biding its time.
You can suppress the virus, and if you stop therapy, the virus comes back. So it's a cure. It's a functional, what we call a functional cure. But it's not a cure.
The drug that your team created, this is the late 80s, was 3TC.
We worked on 3TC, and we also worked on a similar drug called FTC. And FTC was the one that's put in the combination to prevent transmission of virus. But making 3TC was not trivial. I was very fortunate to collaborate with a scientist in the chemistry department called Dennis Liotta and one of his postdocs called Wu-Bei Choi. And together, we came up with a methodology for making these compounds effectively. And we were fortunate that the methodology was used by GSK to make more than 4 tons of 3TC for clinical trials.
Initially, you were publishing papers about these new compounds, filing patents. But I gather you didn't get a huge amount of notice from the rest of the scientific community.
Yes, people hated nucleosides because in the early anti-HIV drugs, were nucleosides like AZT, and AZT had a lot of bone marrow issues, bone marrow toxicity issues. And, you know, so they had a bad name. And I had the job to convince the whole scientific community that what we had didn't cause any of these problems. And in fact, they're very clean, what we call very clean drugs.
And then your drugs are combined with chemotherapy, and that became a game-changing treatment for people with HIV.
Correct, especially when the protease inhibitors became available. We didn't work on protease inhibitors. The drug companies and academic institutions work on protease inhibitors. But when you combine them together, two nucleosides and one protease inhibitor, you had very powerful effects. So by 1996, HIV had changed completely. Mm-hmm. We had mortality rates in the 80s to 90% that dropped to 20% and below because of the triple combinations.
I mean, it's hard to emphasize just how important these advancements were because, as I say, initially HIV was a death sentence. In fact, you lost a cousin to the virus, I believe.
Yes, in 1990, I lost my cousin to HIV. And it was the saddest thing in the world because I was so close. I knew what I had in my hands, and I knew that if I had enough of it, I would give it to him, and at least he would live a few more years. But unfortunately, I couldn't do that. We didn't know enough about our drugs and the safety of our drugs. It had to go through the whole rigmarole of all the testing that we did to get it to be approved by the US FDA. But clearly, it was the saddest moment, and I'm sure there are many people on the planet who have lost somebody to AIDS. It's a devastating disease.
I want to move on, Ray, from HIV to another viral disease. In the early 2000s, you and your team started working on a drug to treat hepatitis C, and would end up creating something many had thought impossible, a cure. We're going to come to that in a moment. But first, could you tell me a little bit more about that virus? How does the Hep C virus, or HCV, affect the body? What are the symptoms?
Basically, hepatitis, I mean inflammation of the liver, it causes jaundice, basically. But what happens, you get fibrosis caused by the virus and eventually cancer, and you die of cancer unless you have a liver transplant.
Well, as is usually the case, the solution came via a team effort. Could you talk me through how this drug came into being, how it works? Because it's a complicated process.
Yeah, so we tried to get funding for this and we couldn't get any funding. So I had to set up a company. And I found a company called Pharmacet, and I hired some of the best people that I could find who wanted to work with us. And we had a scientist by the name of Jeremy Clark, a very brilliant young chemist. And I told him to go and try to make something that specifically with the fluorine here and a methyl group here. And it was not easy to make. People had tried to make them, much more seasoned chemists in my group. They were unable to make it. But he made about 3 milligrams, and it turned out to be a hit. And that was the beginning of what we now today know as sofosbuvir.
That's the compound that stops the virus replicating, is that
right? Yes, and it's very unique because in itself, the compound is not active. But when you make a modification to it, it's taken up by the cells, specifically liver cells, and then goes all the way to the active form and interferes with the RNA of the virus. And on its own, it cured maybe 80% of the people with HCV. Unheard of at the time, because the best treatment was giving you 30, 40% at the most. But when you combine it with another molecule, you get 92% or more cure rates. This is cure, not treatment. And the reason why we're able to cure it is because in the case of hepatitis C, there's no latent form, there's no dormant form.
Unsurprisingly, this drug was a hit because this was game-changing. It was an actual cure.
Correct. Everybody now talks about cure. Before, nobody talked about cure for viral diseases. Of course, we knew about cures for bacterial infection or yeast infection, but nobody had ever thought you could have a cure for a viral disease. We still don't have a cure for herpes simplex virus. We still don't have a cure for hepatitis B. We still don't have a cure for HIV. Mm. But we're going to get there.
Because we know what can be done for
it's possible.
Hep C.
It's you possible.
Have to think. Yeah. But it wasn't all plain sailing. In 2011, Ray, you sold the rights to this drug to the pharmaceutical giants Gilead. But after they had huge success with it, they were taken to court by another major pharma company, Merck. They'd bought the patent for a similar drug from a former colleague of yours. And without going into all the very technical claims, essentially, he was claiming sole copyright, saying your version was reliant on his earlier work. Now, you and your former colleague were really out of the frame. This was a copyright battle between two major corporations. And in 2021, the US Supreme Court ruled in favour of Gilead, so on your side. But something like that dragging on for so long can't have been pleasant. Did it take a toll on you personally?
Well, I was deposed, I don't know how many times, by both sides. But in the end result is what matters. The end result is that the patients benefited. That's the most important thing. And also, Gilead's prevailed. And Pharmacet's name also prevailed. But there's always a lawsuit when you're successful. So you get used to it. And you know you're successful and somebody sues you.
One way of putting it. Well, Ray, onwards and upwards, that's not the end of the Hep C story. In 2011, you were at a conference in Hawaii when you got an unexpected call from the Egyptian ambassador to the US.
Yes, I got this call out of the blue. And I thought it was a hoax or something. Because Egyptian government, Egyptian official have never contacted me before. They never wanted anything from me. They had taken everything we had. I didn't know what they wanted. Maybe they were calling me to say, hey, here's your father's money. You can have it back. But that didn't happen. He told me about the situation in Egypt, which I already knew was 1 in 5 people in Egypt was infected with hepatitis C. That's a huge rate. And they wanted the drug, even though it was licensed to Gilead at the time. So they invited me to come to Egypt.
I mean, given your family's history in Egypt, how did you feel about the prospect of going back?
To me, it was a healing experience. I was hesitant at first, as you can imagine. There was a lot of turmoil even those days in Egypt in 2012. Mm-hmm. But it was a huge problem in Egypt. Everybody's family was affected one way or the other. And I decided in February 2012 to pack my bag and visit Cairo for the first time in more than 50 years. It was very, very emotional for me. And it was fantastic.
So you ended up liaising with the company who now own the drug, Gilead, and helping the Egyptian government secure this treatment for a tiny fraction of its retail cost.
Yes, clearly Egypt could not afford it. So they wanted a deal, and I helped negotiate the deal, and they were happy to get started with, I think they got 250,000 doses, enough to treat 250,000 people, just to show that it actually works.
And since then, you've actually helped several other countries with high rates of hep C gain access to the drug, either for minimal cost or even for free.
Yes. In fact, Egypt, we've cured more than 6 million Egyptians so far. Egypt is no longer a red zone. It's a green zone for hepatitis C. But the company agreed to give the drug free of charge in the Republic of Georgia. And I raise my hat to them for doing that.
And on the drug development side, I hear there are a couple of very exciting breakthroughs on the horizon.
Yes, we have a drug that is entering phase 2 clinical trials for hepatitis B. We're optimistic, very optimistic about it, but cautiously optimistic. Then we're also working on HIV, trying to find a cure, but it's going to be a functional cure, meaning instead of taking pills or injections every day like we do now, it'd be one shot and you're done.
Wow.
Using a genetic approach. So we're very excited about that too.
I mean, when these come off, it would mean you've had a hand in successful treatments for hepatitis C, hepatitis B, and HIV. That's quite a legacy.
Yes, they say jamais deux sans trois. Never two without three in French. And also, I learned from a long time ago that impossible is not in my vocabulary.
Well, that's an excellent attitude. On that note, Ray Shenazi, merci beaucoup for sharing your life scientific.
Thank you so much. Thank you.